this article was a lot of fun for me, primarily because it's one of those moments in my scholarship where my personal life kind of intersected with my scholarship. And what it was actually, if you read the article and you look at a lot of the videos that I'm talking about, was one of those things where one of my friends had actually brought the article to me, and so or the videos to me, and he came to my house, and we were it was in Tempe here across town when I used to live here, and brought the videos in, and he said, hey, check this out, look at these idiots that are supporting McCain. Can you believe how racist they are? Can you believe how ugly they are? I mean, just look at it, it's awful. And I was really intrigued by them at first. I was kind of caught up in it, and I was like, oh, I believe that McCain supporters could be like this. And then I sort of sat back and started thinking about it. I'm like, well, wait a minute here. There's something else going on. And so as I started to think more critically about what was going on in those, after the election had ended, but the videos were still there online, I spent some time sort of thinking critically about how they were put together and the types of arguments that they were offering. And so from that, I started to build this idea of, what is it about YouTube? What is it about new media that fosters this type of discourse? And so one of the arguments that I wanted to get at is how, we celebrate so much the use of digital media and digital technologies. And since roughly 2000, where you started having some of the earliest arguments about how candidates were using digital media, there's been just an explosion of scholarship talking about, oh, look how democratizing this is, how participatory it is. It's wonderful. It's democracy 2.0. And I've always been somewhat skeptical of that. And so my skepticism shines, I think, through this article in a way where you have this moment where people are participating in democratic politics, they're participating in the election, but they're doing so under the guise of some really nasty argumentation strategies. And so I was really concerned about that and drew from a couple different theorists to try to make an argument about the nature of spectacle and especially how it's used by individuals. And so political spectacle is something that's been discussed in a number of contexts, and I wanted to add to that by saying it's not just theater now. It's not just something that's staged. It's not some sort of image event in DeLuca's terminology for it, but now people can actually make them digitally quite easily from their home computers, and so I wanted to be able to make an argument about that. Now, the hardest thing about the article, and if you have a question about this, I'll founder through it, I suppose, but the hardest thing about this article was watching the videos over and over and over and over again. And that was disturbing. I think my wife was probably in the background wondering, why are people screaming so much? What is going on? And so that was entertaining. But the hardest thing was be able to make an argument about these particular videos, and especially the way that they're constructed, to where the authors of the videos are calling out things. What's that?
Nope, go on. You're good.
Okay. The authors of the videos, the videographers, are calling out really ugly things like racism and xenophobia. And so seeing all those things and wanting to agree with them, but disagreeing on how they make that argument. And so one of the concerns that I have is the sort of rhetorical packaging of the argument here is bad, although the kernel of the argument, what's inside the box, I suppose, is something that's I agree with. I don't like to see these racist discourses, these xenophobic discourses. And so it was. I was torn during that section of the article, but and actually Damien helped me out quite a bit in trying to sort through how to make this argument and try to come to a solid conclusion about the practice of the argument construction, while still being able to say that, hey, look, racism is bad here. I'm not defending what's going on with the McCain supporters. So that's sort of the short version of how the article came to be, and I hope that people can use the piece to sort of look at how election practices have changed in the last decade and especially how they continue to change. And I suppose that you all will probably have some questions about the current election, so we'll talk about that quite yet. But yeah, that's the sort of short version on where the piece came from.
What is the relationship between fallacious arguments and polarization or this extremist rhetoric that creates such a divide in the political community?
Sure, great question. And to me, all of that has its foundation in things like spectacle. And that's why I drew from the public screen and DeLuca's work pretty heavily there, because the spectacle, if you think of the world as having sort of two opposites when it comes to argumentation, sort of a rational deliberative model and then a spectacular model. And so in these different models, you'd have presidential debates are a great example of this, where the debates can be about actual rational arguments and how they're traded, Or they can be like, let's focus on what the candidates were wearing, you know, or look at how much Joe Biden smiled during the debate or something like that. And those sorts of things that distract, I think, from actual argumentation practices. Now, the tough part is the belief that we've always been deliberative. And there's this tendency to say, if we could just get back to the time where people listened to arguments. And I don't know that that actually ever existed, although we oftentimes desire it. And I think the spectacle has gotten worse over the last few years with, you know, modern media. So to me, fallacy and the fallacious argument construction goes hand in hand, because the spectacle is very good at hiding rational and critical rational debate. And so as a consequence, you can get away with a lot more, and oftentimes the fallacious argument, especially visual ones, are ones that are really compelling. And so, you know, rather than taking the time to pick through the evidence, the people that were being videotaped could basically, you know, they could be sort of cherry-picked to make the best argument, even though it was fallacious. And I think that the spectacular politics breeds a sort of a lack of critical understanding of argument and lack of appreciation for good argument. And as a consequence, it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle where people aren't trained to read through, you know, what is good argument, and instead can really pick up on and enjoy spectacular politics. In some cases, that can be good. And so if you haven't read the DeLuca and Peoples piece, you know, sometimes throwing a brick through a window can grab the attention of media to hear an argument. But in this case, I think what happens is, you know, compiling people together into a video blog and makes everyone that supports John McCain a racist is not good deliberative politics.
There's lots of examples of YouTube videos where video is taken and edited, speeches are edited out of context, like the McCain bomb Iran, Barbara Ann video, and the Obama's "you didn't build that" comment. What impact do you think that has on polarization, the way those videos are edited?
The editing process does a couple things, and there's a bug near the screen. The editing process does a couple of things, and for one, I think that it allows for a sense of credibility, and because a lot of times the editing is something that we don't look at, and this was especially true in what I call the vernacularly produced videos. You know, those are videos produced by individuals who can enjoy both the credibility of being right there, you know, that I was there, here's my video camera, and I'm capturing everything. But the editing tools make it look very crafty, to where it looks like it's almost naturally found. And so the editing is done in such a way where people don't realize the way that arguments are being put together. Consequently, it really feeds into a polarized world, because you've got the credibility of the video camera, which we perceive to be a very powerful tool. I mean, I just captured reality. Look, there it is. You've got the credibility of the camera coupled with an edited argument that leads to a very strong one-sided approach. And if you couple that with other sorts of things like captioning, and so you have lots of captions that are added in the videos that are dictating to people, not only should you read it in this way, here's what you should do with it afterwards. And so the captioning adds to that problem, I think. But overall, the editing procedures allow for the argument to remain visually sound, but polarized to one extreme regarding the debate at hand.
How are the 2012 candidates exploring vernacular spectacle today? Like, how are they using it? Are they using it more today than they were in 2008 to benefit themselves?
Well, the one thing that I think is it wasn't necessarily that it was the official candidates that were using vernacular spectacle as much. I think they enjoyed the consequences of it. I'm certain that the Obama campaign back in 2008 saw these videos on YouTube and said, this is great for us, let it go, and said, you know, that's perfectly fine. But I think this campaign has been a little bit different. And so it's not that the campaigns have pushed for this. I mean, they might, I don't know. I suppose they could have people that are trying to create the videos to look more authentic and you know, deploy those tactics. But this campaign has been a little bit different. I haven't seen as much on YouTube, not as much activity, which has been curious. I think there was something about the 2008 election that led it to be pretty derisive, you know, and divisive. And as a consequence, it really bred those polarized arguments. I think we're just as polarized now. But there's something about the tenor of this campaign that doesn't lead to as much of that. Now, that being said, I still think it's going on. The more famous videos for this campaign, there's if you haven't seen them, the Obama phone video, if you haven't found that. There's a woman that makes this funny claim. She's, you know, that Obama's going to give everyone free phones. And so there's a video that's viral out there that's talking about that. There are, and actually what I've seen in this campaign that's very different, Ron Paul supporters actually did a lot more of this work during the primaries than I expected. And so there was a lot of that work done where Ron Paul supporters were pushing on Romney supporters to say, is he really conservative? What are his actual values and things? And so that's been another big shift that I've seen in this campaign compared to the last. I do think, however, that, you know, when it comes to general politics, this phenomena will continue to occur. We did see it in the 2010 election, midterm elections. There was some work done on the Tea Party movement, and people were making the same arguments where they were going to the Tea Party rallies and saying, you know, look at these idiot Tea Partiers and look what they, you know, the arguments they make. And so I think that it is it's something that's going to continue in contemporary politics at the very least.
You know, the notion of an idiot opponent montage sort of points to the fallacy of ad hominem, right, attacking
sure.
the person. That, I think, from reading your article, seems to be the prevailing fallacy in terms of sort of race and religion-oriented ad hominem attacks. In what you've seen, is there another fallacy that's emerged as more prevailing in 2012? Or is it just, is there not one that is quite as dominant as the ad hom?
The ad hom is certainly the most powerful one that's out there, but then it's usually paired with a guilt by association, right? And so you have the, you know, look at this particular supporter as representative of the candidate. And so we have that a lot. And so I have seen that in this instance as well. There were a number of videos earlier on that were talking about, you know, that made the explicit connection through captioning and other sorts of things that said, you know, this is what John McCain stands for. You can see it in his supporters. And so that sort of guilt by association, I think, is the strongest fallacy because it's coupled with the ad hom to say, you know, this. It's not to say that this person harbors an extreme view that's actually rational. It's to say this person is an absolute racist and an idiot and is also the same as John McCain. You know, John McCain enjoys the same values. And that's what we saw in 2008. What I do see is on the flip side, and this did happen in 2008, but I wanted to focus on one side of the election, and frankly, the McCain mob rallies were more powerful than the Obama side, because there are Obama supporter videos that are out there. And so I think this is not like a right-left sort of thing. I think it's just a phenomenon that has to do with digital media. I do see out there this time around, there are a couple of interesting things. One, you do see some Obama supporter videos that are montages of people. And one of the prevailing arguments that's interesting is to find African Americans and get them on camera saying, I'm voting for him because he's black. And that's an interesting tactic that did happen in the last election, but I'm finding that more this time around as I poke around on YouTube a little bit. The other thing that I found today as I was looking around, which is interesting, is I found a video that was a part of my analysis in 2008 that has been recycled for 2012 about Romney supporters. And so I think that's an interesting little digital tidbit there that shows how easy it is to manipulate these technologies to basically make the same argument twice and say it stands for. And again, the comments, you know, I can't believe Romney supporters would say this. Look how racist they are. Look how ugly they are. And I mean, if anyone was paying attention, of course, I'm a little weird that way, but paying attention 4 years ago, you'd see that was the same video, and it's a bunch of, you know, racists talking really awful things about President Obama, and, you know, same video, just recut.
With the growing prevalence of internet memes like binders full of women and
yes.
horses and bayonets,
yes.
What role do those memes play in both polarization and extremism?
I see them similar in a similar fashion as I do the sort of idiot opponent montages. The difference, I think, though, is that the memes there are they're taking on a different sort of life. Immediately after the binders full of women comment from Romney, you had not only was there the Twitter tracking of that, where it, you know, became its own Twitter account and was going nuts. There was a Facebook account that, you know, within, I don't know, 6-7 hours, it had something like 300,000 likes. It was a Facebook page. And so you have those sorts of things that are now surfacing that are, I think, are a little bit different than the idiot opponent montages. And so it speaks to, I think, a type of character that's being built where you can have things like Facebook that, which I'd have to look back to 2008. I don't think you could do this in the same way, where you can create that sort of character of someone. So you can create a Twitter account and speak as the Binders, or you can create a Twitter account and speak as someone who owns Bayonets and Horses or something like that. And so it adds a sense of character and identity to the meme itself, which is really interesting. The other place that I look for a lot of these memes, if anyone's not familiar with Reddit, Reddit carries these frequently. And so you'll have the usual shot of whether it's, Jean-Luc Picard kind of doing a what the to the camera, or you have other sorts of memes that are created right out of the debates. You had, I think it was one of Romney's sons became an internet meme visually because of the look he had on his face in one of the photographs. And so those sorts of memes are, I think, are becoming increasingly popular. And I think will carry some minor weight, but they do this similar sort of approach where it's to shortcut any actual argument and instead just focus on a very simplistic understanding of whatever it is. You know, it could be an ad hom attack, again, because it's a show, Binders Full of Women. You know, it was a stupid comment from Romney. He should not have said it in that way. But ultimately, he just, he had a poor turn of phrase. That's really what it was. But it's the sort of thing that journalism loves, one, right? And people like to hold on to. And internet culture loves it, right? Internet culture loves memes. And I'm guilty, right? I've made my own lolcats out there and everything. And so, I'm a part of it in a way. But I think that breeds this sort of shortcutting of reason for when it comes to presidential debates that I think is a problem and can, again, intensify some of that polarization. And certainly if you go on Reddit, Reddit does not have any secret about, generally speaking, who Redditors are voting for in the election. And so you see that in the way the memes surface is that they're very polarized to the left. And so that's not too much of a surprise to me.
What's up with YouTube comments?
My dear Lord, yes.
And just what is it about? Is it the internet culture? Is the same with blogs that just attracts a lowest common denominator? Or why is that the worst place in the whole internet?
There's a lot of reasons for the internet being the way that it is. And I've studied a lot of things on digital culture, and I try my best to try to keep an open mind about it. On the whole, I do believe, I have another piece that I published in 2009 about YouTube, and I spend more time talking about both visual argument and comment argument. And what I do see is that there is a really lack of deliberative efficacy on online. People just, even in moments where they really want to try to have debates, they fail, either because it leads to some sort of frivolous discussion or it ends up in user flaming and people just, being, combative with each other. And I think there's a couple different reasons for it. One is the easiest is the sort of cloak of anonymity that people are allowed to wear when they go online. And I know that there's an attempt by Google, who owns YouTube, to change this, where they want to have people using real names and have it connected to, like, your Google Plus account and other sorts of things. And more frequently, journalism websites are trying to say, log in through your Facebook. And so there's some accountability there. But ultimately, even with those measures, the internet feels like a very anonymous space. And as a consequence, people can do some pretty nasty things to each other, when it comes to, internet debate, like call each other awful names. I think it's, Monroe's Law is a joke on the internet where any discussion board after, 30 posts will, by law, will mention Hitler or Nazis. And so it's those sorts of things that really dominate, sadly, internet discussion boards and things. And so to answer what's up with the internet, one, people can hide a lot, and they do. And so being anonymous it allows them to do that. They're allowed to speak freely, and oftentimes they don't, since it's an asynchronous medium mostly, they can just post, and once it's out there, it's kind of out there. And so they get to, there isn't any sort of feedback. There's no nonverbal feedback. You don't actually see the people that you're calling Nazis. You just do it and it's done and it's out there. And a lot of people, I think, feel that it's an inconsequential space that, it doesn't matter. It's just the internet. Oh, it's just, it's just YouTube posts, just YouTube comments. And so as a consequence, don't think that it means much and will continue to speak in that way. And that's, I think, is a problem, especially because we prize it as a tool for democracy. I mean, I tell you, when I read the literature from, if you get a chance to do this, in like the mid-90s when the internet was just kind of surfacing, and people were so excited about it, you know, like, oh, it's going to change everything. And it changed a lot of things. But when it comes to politics, there's some pretty nasty stuff out there. And this sort of polarization, I think, only breeds it. Mm-hmm. I think the other side of this you have to remember is, and this is hard to say, you know, it's a chicken and egg sort of thing. Is it the internet that breeds polarization, or does polarization breed the type of discourse you find on the internet? And that's a tough question that I really don't have an answer to. But I do know that there's, you know, they correlate. You know, they tend to go together, but I don't know which one causes the other. So maybe if we were in a happier time, and maybe that's what it was, you know, the Clinton years, people were less polarized and happier, more optimistic. Maybe that's part of it.
I believe you mentioned in your article, you talk about Sunstein and his idea of the echo chamber and being able to be selective with the media that you're looking at all the time. Do you think that phenomenon has gotten worse as we're moving into the 2012 elections? And how do you see that affecting polarization and extremism today?
That's a good question. And I'm glad you brought up Sunstein, because I meant to bring it up in the answer to the last question, and I got lost in either lolcats or something. I don't know. Sunstein, hold on, I'm getting blinded here. Sunstein's got some really cool arguments about the nature of polarization in modern media, and he has what he calls the daily me, which is a nice way of thinking about it, that you've got media that you can basically cater to yourself and all of your interests. And what that leads to is that you can log on, you know, wake up in the morning and grab your smartphone or hop on the computer, your iPad, whatever, and everything is catered to who you are, because you've set it up that way, at least in Sunstein's world. And then, so when he first started doing his work, he was looking at blogs and how you could build things like RSS feeds that would directly send you information from the sorts of sources that you want. And he compared that to a lot of like small group literature, looking at how people will polarize in the context of small groups. And that leads to some political arguments that are really pushed to one side or the other. And if you've taken courses in small group, you learn about this as well, of risk-taking and polarization. But when it comes to the modern-day election, the 2012, there's another element here that it's a piece that I'm working on right now, that there's not only is it that we choose the sorts of sources, so we have like a sense of confirmation bias, or, you know, we are uses and gratification, we seek out the things that we want, you know, because of, you know, whatever it is. There's also a technological element of this that has changed in recent years, and this largely appears through things like internet cookies. And so if you're familiar with how web browsers and things work, you have the internet is put together where you visit a website and it deposits a cookie on your computer, and the cookie basically has a record of your preferences, what you did on the site, what you searched for, what you looked at, how long you're on the site. And it also trades information with the website, you know, usually demographic information about who you are, and your other sorts of searches, so it can start to cater to who you are. And Google is a great example of this. As a consequence of the technology itself, I believe that we're actually the polarization is getting worse by just using the technology, which we presume to be a neutral source. And so what you have is a growing problem of the technology putting us on these tracks where it's like, oh, this is what you believe in, I'll send you there. This is what you want, right? And cookies, I think, you know, as algorithms, as little programs, are really pushing us in that direction. And it's something that I think Sunstein didn't see in his original analysis because it wasn't as pervasive as it is now. You can actually, if you install cookie tracking software on your computer, you'll be able to see how often cookies are deposited on your machine. And it's really quite surprising, kind of eerie, really, to see how much people are tracking your search behavior. But as a consequence, you know, in Sunstein's world, it was a choice. You know, I choose to go to Little Green Footballs, or, you know, whatever website that you like, whatever blog that you like. And that echo chamber is a consequence of you seeking out what you want to see. And so then it echoes your own opinion back to you. And then that echo, which is kind of the opposite metaphor here, the echo gets louder, not softer, as it continues, because people keep bouncing off these ideas. And so as a consequence, you know, people really, really strongly held beliefs. I think that the technology itself is doing that in ways that aren't connected to choice, at least not conscious choice. And so consequently, our identities on the internet are forged in a way through the technology, through cookies, that already speaks to our political beliefs, our consumer activities and behaviors, and our social circles. And as a consequence, the echo chamber is not something we even see anymore. So, for instance, the way that you, Shelby, would search for something political on Google would be and what you find would be drastically different than what I would find based upon my search terms and your search terms. So we're, even before we get started, we've already are in different paths. And we think of a Google search as being neutral. It's just a Google search. But the reality is that technology is building us in such a way to where it's already pushing us in one direction, and it's usually a direction that we enjoy. So it's harder to find competing information because Google or other sorts of search engines just don't want us to because we don't like it. And I think that's a growing problem that we'll see in time. And it's the sort of work that I'm writing right now and trying to publish is that sort of argument.
You know, the diagnoses of polarization are quite prevalent, you know, in terms of causal reaction or causal stimulants to polarization. The solutions, you know, ways to depolarize are much rarer. So we have two questions kind of oriented around that. One of them is it possible to have videography that does not ultimately tend towards polarizing? Or is the entertainment-driven nature of YouTube just sort of inevitably drive the videographers and the edited videos to become kind of incendiary and polarizing? And is it any better with professional news montages? Or are they falling into the same kinds of traps that vernacular video editors are falling into?
To me, sadly, and this is the cynic in me, sadly, I think that the infotainment element of the public screen has become exceptionally powerful. One of the theorists that I draw from is Howard, and he has this notion of dialectical vernacular. And when he talks about dialectical vernacular, he says that vernacular sources, individuals who gravitate towards digital media, will draw from institutional sources to make their arguments, and vice versa. So you have someone that will, to create an internet meme, will steal an image of Patrick Stewart on Star Trek to make an internet meme. That's the vernacular stealing from the institutional. Simultaneously, you'll have campaign. You know, you watch the Daily Show, and on the bottom corner of the Daily Show, you have a hashtag Daily Show, so you can talk back, and that becomes a part of the show. You do it with CNN or anything, and so the logic of the two work together. That people are really trying to do a sort of a simultaneous approach to media production. As a consequence, what has become and has led to an increasing polarization is that infotainment mindset. That what's desirable from the producer standpoint, because it's what sells, is the very easy shortcut, the sensationalized, the dramatic, the violent. And so all of those sorts of things, you know, support an attitude of this. I want to have what sells. I want to have what's quick to digest. I want to have what, again, is easy to understand. Deliberative democracy, in the fullest sense of it, is slow and frankly is boring, which is why nobody watches C-SPAN. And so C-SPAN is the place where you should see these sorts of things, even though you don't oftentimes when you watch C-SPAN. But this is the place that you should see this sort of work in deliberative democracy, but you just don't. And so as a consequence, I think that it is the case that for the vernacular and the institutional would have to break the cycle of infotainment and have some sort of reward for doing so. But right now it's hard to realize what that might be. And so that's where I get hung up about, okay, how do you do this? Part of me thinks that if there are critical consumers of the news, and if people, frankly, in my opinion, stop watching the news and start reading the news more frequently, I think that's a better way, because as a passive medium, it allows you to take in the information in a very different way. I think that's one thing that can help. It fosters the ability to evaluate argument more critically. But the other thing is and I encourage it with my own students, is to seek out sources that are counter to your own beliefs. And so if you're someone who reads the New York Times frequently, pick up the Wall Street Journal and see what they have to say. And I think that those are ways on a personal level to start to shortcut the polarization if you find yourself, you know, just hearing the same arguments over and over again. But on the video production level, and especially in new media, you know, one of the reasons why I think that this phenomenon occurred on YouTube is because it enjoys that space of being both institutional and vernacular put together. And so it really is an institution run by Google that's ad-driven, and you know, to get views, just like you saw in the analysis, to get views, you need to be more explosive, more, you know, find more racism, more ugliness. That's how you get views. I did find a couple of videos that were interviewing Obama supporters. There was one in particular that comes to mind that were interviewing Obama supporters that were articulating fully their opinions and intelligently their opinions about why they were voting in 2008 for Barack Obama. And then the view count was like a couple hundred. You know, it was nothing. And then you have the person running around with the microphone, who thinks Barack Obama's a terrorist? Who thinks Barack Obama's a terrorist? And that video has something like 2 million. And so it's, I don't know what is needed to shortcut that cycle, but right now we love it. I mean, look at Honey Boo Boo.
Please don't make us.
I know, you shouldn't, right. But, you know, theoretically, look at, you know, and that sort of world, I think, is sadly is what people are gravitating towards. And the producers do it too. And, you know, these are old arguments to a certain extent. You know, Gerbner in cultivation theory talked about this when it comes to violence in television. And, you know, we turn to violence and because, or media producers turn to violence because it translates internationally. You know, everyone can watch a fight and understand one person won and one person lost. Good guys, bad guys, easy story. You know, complex arguments, humor, satire, very hard to translate across cultures. And so they don't sell. And so people don't produce them.
You suggest in your article that empirical research into attitudes, values, and motivations can help illuminate the decision calculus into the production of this spectacle. And just considering it's sort of hard to see empiricism taking a foothold in this culture, can you prescribe any ideas or envision some way in which we could find some solutions with empiricism?
The empirical, the sense of the word empirical there is to go and, because what I've done is more a textual analysis, mm-hmm. I'd be curious to see if we could go out and actually work with people to see how they make the choices. And there's, so when I speak of empiricism there, my argument is, hey, go and, you know, this is the ethnographer side of me, go and hang out with people and as they're doing this sort of work and try to see how it goes. Mm-hmm. The closest that I've come is in my own, I've done some minor video production with a colleague back in Indiana, and we have a YouTube channel called Living Text where we try to produce our own sorts of work, and we did some work at the Rally to Restore Sanity. And I had a funny moment. If you're not familiar with the rally, it's, you know, Jon Stewart 2 years ago had the Rally to Restore Sanity and or Fear, which he co-hosted with Stephen Colbert on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and we shot a short documentary while we were there, and all of that's kind of an aside to how I was there at the rally and someone came up to me and thought that I was a video blogger from New Left Media because I kind of looked like that guy. And so I had this funny moment where this guy came up and he's like, oh, you're the New Left Media guy. I really love your work. And so I thought to myself, wouldn't it be funny to find people as they're shooting these videos and ask them questions about how they produce this sort of work? And I would love to be able to do that, you know, and having dabbled in some production myself, I can see how the editing process, you know, is desirable to make a compelling argument. And so my colleague and I, when we edited our short film, you know, we have to make choices. And so there's two hands to, I think, to this. One is to be as, you know, this is not really empiricism, but to be a part of the media production to understand how it works, I think is a valuable approach. And so if you can understand why people make the editing choices that they do by trying the editing out, I think is a good thing. But I would love to do some work where it's more of a digital ethnography or a rhetorical ethnography, kind of, where I would hang out with the video producers and, you know, ask them questions before and after about what they're doing, watch them as they're doing the work, you know, witness the interviews to see what they sound like to me before they get put up on YouTube. Simultaneously, I would love to go and find people who, and this is everywhere, if you go to a political rally or at the Rally to Restore Sanity for that matter, everyone's got some sort of camcorder, cell phone, whatever they're holding, and just, you know, taking video of everything. I would love to be able to talk to people to ask them questions about what's the point of that? What do we do with that? You know, what will you, put that on YouTube? What does that mean? Those sorts of questions that I think can get at the decision calculus. Like, you know, okay, so you've made the decision to put this on YouTube. Why? Why did you make the decision to edit like this? And so one potential project that you could do, and I'd love to do, is contact people who have made these videos and conduct interviews or possibly surveys, for that matter, that get at, you know, why the, or what decisions they made and why they made them leading up to the production of those videos. And so that's the sort of empirical side that I'm sort of pushing. If there's a different argument about empiricism, it's something about, is that kind of what you meant?
Yeah,
or?
That's exactly what I meant. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. I just want to make sure. But the ethnographer side of me speaking, go hang out with people and ask them questions.